Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're joined as we are every Monday by Doug Keck, and we'll be talking about the intersection of faith and reason. We're going to take a deeper dive into some of the thoughts of Father Robert Spitzer, but largely just the overall dialogue of the fact that reason and natural phenomena has as its roots the faith. The faith is the only thing that illuminates all of these phenomena and even the encounter of natural reason and reality in light of the only way to find meaning. So we talk about near-death experiences, we talk about the existence of God, and ultimately we talk about how we have an obligation to exercise our reason to its fullest, that we may greater penetrate the mysteries of human life and ultimately of divine revelation. We move on from there to speak about the four forgotten martyrs of the American Southwest. On July the 17th, 1781, in Yuma, Arizona, it was like virtually all July days, except that there would be an uprising from the Ketchin Indians that would result in the massacre of many Spaniards, but including especially the four Franciscan martyrs of the American Southwest, Father Francisco Garces and his companions. They were killed on that day and in the days following. Their story resonates to this day, and Jeremy Beers, who has written about their life, joins us to speak about this, because their heritage is one that baptized the nation with their blood for the sake of the greater propagation of the Christian heritage and the great heritage of Western civilization itself. And then, in the last two segments of the hour, we speak with Mary Moorman about indulgences. This book was published by Emmaus Academic. It's a brilliant book, it's well written, and it has to do with engaging Luther's theology in light of the Catholic Church's teaching on indulgences. Luther didn't think a lot of things to their natural conclusion, but the fact is, while indulgences was one of the most well-known issues he had against the faith, his sola fide theology actually provides the framework for absolutizing the very logic of the indulgences. And this notion of the imputation of merit, first from Christ, but the Catholic Church takes it a step further into the Church and therefore into the lives of the faithful. So let's talk about indulgences and learn how to seek them well for the salvation of our own souls and that of others. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, October 21st. It's the feast of St. Gaspar of Buffalo. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Pope Francis will publish the fourth encyclical of his pontificate on Thursday on the human and divine love of the heart of Jesus Christ. The encyclical, titled Del Excess Nos, meaning He Has Loved Us, will be published October 24th. The encyclical is being published amid the celebrations of the 350th anniversary of the apparitions of the Sacred Heart of Jesus to St. Margaret Mary. Both presidential candidates are campaigning in key battleground states in the final 2 weeks before Election Day. Former President Trump visited North Carolina today to tour hurricane damage in Asheville and later will hold a rally in Greenville. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris is making a series of stops in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania with former Congresswoman Liz Cheney. Boeing has reached a tentative deal with its machinist union that could end a weeks-long strike. The new contract would include a 35% wage increase over the next 4 years, higher 401k contributions, guaranteed payouts in a bonus program, and a higher signing bonus. A vote to ratify the deal is set for Wednesday. And so long, Providence. Hello, Boston. The new Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Boston bid a fond farewell to Rhode Island. Archbishop Richard Henning was appointed in August by Pope Francis to succeed 80-year-old Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who is retiring. At a Mass in Providence, Henning said it has been an extraordinary couple of years in the Diocese of Providence. He said he looks forward to exciting new challenges in Boston, but that he takes lessons learned in Rhode Island with him. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Doug Keck, President and COO of EWTN. Doug is also the host of EWTN Bookmark, and his most recent episode, Father Robert Spitzer, discussed questions about near-death experiences, creation of the universe, and the like. Doug, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me on, as you do each week, and it's great to kind of be on this particular topic, because not only is it a book show that I get to host and some wonderful authors I get to talk to, but also I talk to my good buddy, Father Robert Spitzer, who I get to co-host his wonderful program, Father Spitzer's Universe, Mr. Universe, as we call him himself. So it was kind of a lot of fun to do the book interview as well.
So let's talk about exactly that, right? Near-death experiences. So you and Father Robert Spitzer, this is not the first time you've addressed issues pertaining to this question, but it's one of those questions that Catholics tend to be rather iffy about. Many people don't want to go near it. And yet it's a question that's important for us to at least be conversant about.
Yeah, absolutely. Any of us who have been in media know about dying on the air, so we're somewhat familiar with that issue. More so than many other people might be. But you're right. And I think one of the things that Father brings out in one of the sections in the book, which are based on the questions that he answered on the program over the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. So those are the actual answers and those are the actual questions. They also includes my follow-up questions off of the original question and his responses. So in the near-death area, I think one of those is, again, I think we're living in a culture where people are starting to realize that what the culture offers, this scientism, this materialism, mm-hmm. it just doesn't work. And people of faith want the reinforcement, the positive reinforcement of understanding that, yes, there is more, that what the church teaches about heaven and hell and purgatory and the saints and Our Lady in heaven, that those things are true, and one of the ways to kind of be able to bridge that science gap, that faith and reason, is to be able to see scientifically that more and more things indicate that there is some sort of something beyond even science can see.
Right.
That beyond death there is some sort of ability for consciousness. And certainly Father talks about many of the situations where you have terminal lucidity, people who've been in comas come out of it for a short period of time and take care of certain business, or they tell you what's going on with near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, being able to tell you, outside on the ledge is a sneaker on the second floor, or a train. A young man, he always tells the story about a young man who was blind, who talks about this train that he saw going by the hospital. First of all, he had no idea it was there. Second of all, he was blind, so how could he have seen it? So those are the kinds of things, I think, that allow believers especially, and also non-believers, but believers to say, yes, see, these are the indications, these are the little senses that our Lord gives us to help us along that path. Because at the end of the day, it's all about faith. If we had absolute proof, it wouldn't require faith.
And that's true. Just like you mentioned, if we had absolute certainty, it wouldn't require faith because, as we know statistically, only 9% of adults encounter near-death experiences. Those who actually die, only 9% report near-death experiences, about 91% don't. But the vast majority of narratives that we have about near-death experiences come from children who've encountered some level of death and been resurrected. So the question of divine providence and what God is trying to say here is at play as well.
Absolutely. And of course, not to say that it's not, but who's to say there aren't 100%, but only 9% remember them? We can't guarantee that just because someone said they didn't experience it or doesn't remember it doesn't mean it didn't happen. I mean, not to say, but and this is unscientific, but, many of us have dreams about things in the next day. Very few of us can remember what their dream might have been about. So it could be much, much higher than those numbers, but we don't know, because obviously if a person said, I don't remember anything like that happening, we have to assume it didn't happen. But it's possible that it did and they just don't recall it. And I think with children, again, they're simpler, and so they take things at face value. And that's why I think in many cases they can report these things, because they're not judging them as to whether, how could that have possibly been true.
Yep. And again, you know, this presents us that huge problem that scientism will never be able to answer. They come up with different theories about what's possibly being seen. One of the theories that I see most prevalently is the neurons are firing at a far more rapid rate to prevent death, but that never accounts for the lucidity of the experiences or the fact that these people conversed with particular individuals. And most of all, it doesn't account for their encountering some level of a divine presence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think many times it's like a lot of things related to the faith, whether it can be things, issues of abortion or issues of these kinds of things. There's many people who don't want to believe them, have stood against them and are desperate to try and prove it's not true. And so, you know, in that case, you are getting that kind of scientific side. But you've also got, as Father mentions many, many times, that more than 50% of the young scientists these days are believers. And more of the scientific community are believers, people who come and said, I've seen too many things to not believe at least the idea that there's a creator, that this isn't just chaos. This is just isn't, you know, some sort of random happening. So that's why I think a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, it's not random, it's a simulation. We're in this this giant simulation that's going on, and that's why things seem to fit together. Because, but even with that, who put together the simulation? Somebody must have. So that's the, you know, the unmoved mover. So you get to that point where you've got to start to say, even, you know, people like Dawkins and stuff like that, where many have moved from being atheists to at least being agnostics and saying, you know, well, it's not that there's no God, it's that I'm not quite sure anymore because there's so many things out there that I can't quite explain or I thought could be explained turned out to be unexplainable.
Yeah, when that fuel of the initial vitriol that drives atheism fades out, one can't help but acknowledge that I really don't have all the answers. I must, at the very least, grapple with the question of an intelligent mind that's governing order behind the universe, because I can't seem to fathom any other explanation.
Absolutely. And the Greeks saw that, whether it was in mathematics or in anything else. I mean, throughout history, you know, people have seen that there's something going on there. There's something outside of us that's, you know, not manipulating things, but it's organized in such a way that it just isn't happenstance. You know, they always talk about, you know, the monkey typing out, you know, death, you know, this idea that's as likely that would happen by chance as the, you know, a plane coming together, etc., all of these things like that. And I think it's important for people when they hear those things to realize, and that's why, you know, faith and reason is really the central theme behind Father Spitzer's universe. We always say it's the intersection of faith and reason. We even had a sign early on that said, you know, the corner of faith and reason, because that's what he's trying to bridge, because so many young people have been caught up in the, well, I'd like to believe that, but it's not scientific, and, you know, I don't want to be embarrassed. And he gives you the ability to see that from a scientific perspective, most of these things are realistic ideas. They don't prove things, but much of science is unproven. And, you know, I used to say, and this is an unscientific thing, I used to say, if you took the Creed in 325 and a medical journal in 325, you tell me which one's closer to being correct today. The Creed's the same. It hasn't changed. I'm sure you wouldn't want, you know, Nordrick from Niacin to be working on your, you know, as your doctor using the implements in his understanding of the body of 325.
Mm-hmm.
So constant change. Science is always learning more. It's never static.
Yeah.
So what we know today may be slightly different in the future. So we always have to be open-minded in there. But on the faith side, yes, we can grow in greater understanding, but the truths are eternal.
Yeah. Well, Doug, I want to say thank you, as always, for making the time to speak with us. Always enjoy speaking with you.
Likewise, it was great seeing you at the radio conference.
Yep, it was great connecting with you there, too. And it was a wonderful conference. My guest, Doug Keck, President and COO of EWTN, and we've been talking about the question of near-death experiences and how that feeds into everything that we know about divine revelation and ultimately the benevolence of God. God is, and if we do the work and if we're honest with ourselves between faith and our exercise of reason, we can come to living a true, flourishing human life. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Quechan Indians had risen up against Spaniards among them in July 17th of 1781. Now, amongst other things, this uprising resulted in the martyrdom of four forgotten martyrs of the American Southwest. Joining me to have a conversation about their great heritage is Jeremy Beer, who is the author of Beyond the Devil's Road, Francisco Garces, and The Spanish Encounter with the American Southwest. Jeremy, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Pleasure to be here.
So, many people don't know about this narrative, and yet this was a truly benevolent and selfless witness on the part of these four Franciscans. So tell us about them.
Yeah, so to give the context, they're working at the same time that St. Junipero Serra and his colleagues are planting missions along the California coast. And so these are Franciscan friars who are from a different college in today's Mexico. And they were sent to today's Yuma, Arizona, to plant new missions there to help keep the road open from today's northern Mexico to California. And so, as you say, yes, they were there to minister to souls, as all the Franciscan friars were trying to do. But they were also part of the Spanish colonization sort of effort, and they got mixed up in that, in tensions between the Spanish military and Spanish settlers and the Quechan Indians, and ended up paying for those tensions with their lives.
And that's truly sad to hear, but their contemporaries spoke so highly of them that it was very clear that they didn't care about the fact that they were laying down their lives for this mission. They had the ultimate goal of salvation, well, civilization to be sure, but also ultimately catechesis and salvation of souls of everyone who was there.
Very much so. So they knew, Father Francisco Garces is sort of the best known of this group of four, and the best known even at the time. He was known for his remarkable courage in making really sort of insanely dangerous journeys throughout the Southwest, today's Arizona, California, even into Nevada, in order to spread the gospel, to sort of map the landscape of that time with, you know, who was living where, and what were they like, and what was their posture toward the Spanish and Christianity, what religious practices did they have. And so he was sent to Yuma in 1779, in what was known to be a very, very tense situation. Garces had befriended the Quechan Indians and had opened this road, this pathway for the Spanish to travel from today's, again, northern Mexico to California. And he was trying to keep a lid. He was sent there to, hey, try to calm things down, try to make this all good again.
Right, right.
And he knew, you know, there was a desperate situation, as did his colleagues who came with him. And what happened was, essentially, that the Spanish had made a lot of promises about supplies and goods and things like that that weren't kept. And then ultimately, the settlers would come through. Their animals would trample Quechan crops and eat their food and generally treat them poorly. And that's not something you want to do to a proud and warlike people, where you win status by through warfare, like the Quechans. And eventually they got tired of it and rose up. And the fathers, as I say, once that thing sort of thing gets started, nobody is spared.
Yeah, yeah. And if anyone knows the history, it's very clear that the uprising was very targeted. There was a real sense of violence that drove the uprising. North of Yuma, for example, in San Pedro y San Pablo, Fathers Moreno and Diaz, they get targeted. They get beaten to a pulp and then beheaded.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing short of this whole thing is nothing short of violent. The narrative shows very clearly that this was a willful decision on the part of Quechans for the sake of making sure that these men, especially, were done away with.
Yeah. So the obviously the Franciscan friars were seen to be allied with and symbols of Spanish domination. And even though they didn't see themselves that way, of course, and were not, they had larger goals in mind. It was very common if you would get an uprising like this at that time for the priests to be targeted and for violent deaths, to be decapitated with an axe, for example, as I believe Father Moreno was, or to be just clubbed to death or even left to die, sort of a painful death on the field. Yeah, that was very common. It was meant to show by the anti-Spanish forces or voices within the Quechans that this is a total rejection of everything that sort of Spanish Christianity stood for. And yeah, as I said, that was not uncommon when you'd have this sort of thing happen on the frontier.
Yeah.
Priests paid with that violent deaths oftentimes for these sorts of things.
And Jeremy, you take a look at the narratives of how these men went to their death, and it becomes very clear that they knew, they had a complete sense of faithful certitude that the mission that they were living for was infinitely greater than even the loss of life that they were about to endure. And they went forth, they committed themselves to God, and they accepted this, knowing that their term on this earthly sojourn had come to an end, and they were willing to embrace their Creator as a result.
Yeah, they even before the uprising, there was a lot of chatter or writing among them or back to their college that martyrdom might well be their fate, and that they were prepared to accept that. You had to be prepared to accept that if you were working on the frontier at this time. In fact, these friars were selected and trained precisely for this kind of moment. They came from a college, as did Sarah and his companions, that was sort of an elite missionary training center. And to prepare yourself for martyrdom was a part of that training, spiritual training, right?
Yeah.
And so you're exactly right. They knew what could be coming. They accepted it. And when they were found, as Garces and Berenice were, by the rebels, they asked if they could finish their hot chocolate first.
Yeah, that's right. Talk about dark humor.
Yeah, dark humor. They knew what was coming, and they prepared themselves, stepped out of the hut, and were clubbed to death, or to at least within an inch of their lives.
And everyone remembers them as living witnesses of a true Christian charity. You know how we sometimes eulogize a person and we tend to over-aggrandize their heritage as a result. That's not the case with these men. What was testified is really how they lived and how they were. And that was demarcated by how they died as well.
Yeah, so as in any group of any people anywhere, you can find among priests working in California or in New Mexico or here or there, you know, men who are not so great. Mm-hmm. They were not such great examples of their vocations, but that is right. That's not the case with these four men. And Garcés in particular really already had a reputation for saintliness in his time, and immediately afterwards was eulogized as a potential saint, just an incredibly remarkable, likable, courageous character, and deserves really today to be remembered along the same lines as someone like Sarah. He had a very different personality than Sarah, not the sort of the builder and administrator that Sarah was, but a kind of a holy fool type.
Yeah.
Definitely deserves to be remembered today.
I think as a kind of final note, this was an era where there was a decline in the faith and there was a real tide of rise in secularism. And it's in the face of all of this that these four friars still wanted to bring about the propagation of the faith and the civilization, which can only be found in Christ, to cultures that had not known him.
Yes, you're exactly right. The sort of Enlightenment-inspired secularism was leading to calls for reform or calls to sort of dispense with the old mission system in New Spain and to adopt something more secular that was not concerned with souls. And they didn't care. They went forward just as you said.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you, Marcus.
My guest, Jeremy Baer, author of Beyond the Devil's Road, Francisco Garces and the Spanish Encounter with the American Southwest, four martyrs who laid down their life for people who actually didn't appreciate it, and yet they became true witnesses for Christ. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Ave Maria in the Afternoon is sponsored by Workforce Pay Hub, providing payroll, time tracking, HR management, and benefits administration, all with a dedicated customer-centric service team. More information can be found at workforcepayhub.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic. Consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Get detailed descriptions of Ave Maria Radio guests on their website, avemariaradio.net. Go to the archives, find your favorite program, and then find links or books mentioned in that program. That's avemariaradio.net.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I must tell you that from what I observe from very young people, all of these blasphemers, all of these mockers are in for a tough time. Because the devil bites his own tail. And I find among young people a growing reverence and longing for God. I find a decline in the cynicism and skepticism around, because it had to destroy itself. No one can live on being an enemy of God. It's too crazy. It's too absurd. It's too dark. It's too bleak. God is beautiful. God is holy. Why in the world mock God?
The people you know and trust. are on EWTN.
Does unity in the church eliminate diversity? No, says the Catholic Catechism. From the beginning, the Catholic Church has been marked by great diversity. Diversity in God's gifts. Diversity in the multiplicity of cultures and people who are its members. There is even diversity in its particular churches who maintain their own traditions. The Catechism asserts this is not a threat to the Church's unity. Sin, however, and its consequences are a constant threat to unity. The number one bond of unity is charity, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. There are also visible bonds of unity, profession of one faith, common celebration of divine worship, especially the sacraments and apostolic succession through the sacrament of holy orders. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The question of indulgences is one that continues to permeate our culture in terms of conversations about what they really pertain to. How do we best understand indulgences in light of salvation history and the Church's teaching on our salvation? Joining me to have this conversation is Dr. Mary C. Moorman, who is the author of Indulgences, published by Emmaus Academic, Luther, Catholicism, and the Imputation of Merit. Mary holds a Juris Doctor in Law with a focus on religious legal systems from Boston University and a PhD in Systematic Theology from Southern Methodist University. She's also a lecturer in theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Mary, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I read your book with much delight. I also want to credit you for this, that little segment that you have in the first chapter on the nuptial character of the biblical covenants. I drew from that in my master's thesis, and I had largely forgotten about it until I reread this book and realized that I was acquainted with your work a long time ago.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what a gift to hear that. And it's a theme that enlivens everything I try to do. So that's so good to hear.
Well, we share that in common because I greatly appreciated the covenantal overview with which you engaged in this conversation. So we have to start with that. The concept of a covenant has to do with God avowing himself to us in a kind of exchange of lives for the sake of forming a family bond. And it's within that framework that we can understand indulgences as a part of the benevolent love of the Father for his children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think especially at this season of the year, as we're preparing for the Feast of All Saints and All Souls, we're reminded of plenary indulgences that are available in this season. We're reminded that indulgences are authorized for appropriation every single day mm-hmm. of the year in ways that are very accessible by the Catholic churches and Christian. And these are an active part of the church's life, not mm-hmm. just the relics of a 16th century controversy or an outdated mode of legalism kind of hovering around the shadows of the Catholic church's life. These are actually a very vibrant thing that bear witness to the most vibrant and maybe intimate parts of our faith. And that was really a blessing, and it was so rewarding for me to learn so much more about our faith by tracing this stream, this small sort of obscure aspect of Catholic life, to its theological roots in my research. And particularly, as you note, the theme of the covenant is at the very foundation of the concept of indulgences.
Mm-hmm.
It goes hand in hand with the concept of God's mercy. And when we talk about a covenant, we talk about an exchange, right? Like God has provided the offer. He initiates everything. We accept it. We're provided the means for accepting his offer, and we indicate our acceptance by those means. Three steps: offer, acceptance, and an act of acceptance that bears witness to our intention, that sort of signifies the giving of our whole selves
mm-hmm.
to God. And what I love about indulgences is they are purely covenantal, right? Appropriation is inextricable from the sacramental life of the church. They are always appropriated in the context of sacramental communion and penance. and reconciliation. But in themselves, they are all about this exchange with God that is purely covenantal. And in that, I love how they bear witness to the covenantal union between Christ and his church that our scripture and our tradition celebrates.
Yeah. And that's why when you look at it from that perspective and you talk about the treasury of merit that is at the heart of the church and the language of imputation of merit, you start realizing why Lutheran soteriology is completely averse to the language or even the notion of indulgences, even though by itself it shouldn't stand diametrically opposed.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I argued in my book and had a lot of fun with in conversation with my wonderful and gifted advisor, Dr. Bruce Marshall, who understands Luther and Aquinas better than anyone, except our Lord himself. It's high praise. But
I know, that's tremendously high praise. I'm sitting here thinking, I think Stephen Long would beg to differ, but go on, please.
Yeah, sure. So what I thought I saw was that Luther loved this idea of imputation so much, but I think he got it from the church's teaching and practice of indulgences. I think that's where he first learned it himself. Because in the practice of indulgences, God imputes to us the merit of another. That's what we get when we obtain an indulgence, right? We get the merit of Jesus and all of his saints and of Our Lady imputed to us to compensate for our needs and to make up some of the debt that we owe for our sin in sort of a legal and juridical way. And so it's like, you know, all of the riches, all of the merits, all of the holiness of Christ and his saints are attributed to us as though they were our own. Mm-hmm. When we have simply manifested our faith in Jesus and his covenants in, you know, a prescribed little way, you know, reading scripture, going through a pilgrimage or a small fast or an act of charity, and something prescribed in the Incredian to obtain an indulgence, what you get is the imputation of the merits of another applied to you as though they were your own. It's an act of attribution. And Luther, I think, loved this concept so much because it is so consoling. It is such a testimony to the depth of the divine mercy. I think he made it into a whole scheme of salvation in his exuberant way that he proposed, you know, could persist outside of the Catholic Church, because that's really where he was heading. He was hoping to, you know, to get out of the jurisdiction of the Pope. And what better way to do that than to say that everything we have is only attributed to us? We don't need ontological, sacramental union with God as well. So I think he absolutized the logic of indulgences, is what I suggest.
And we have to admit here that a big thrust for Luther's entire movement and his actions was not just doctrinal, that there was a true political impetus at play here. He wanted to, that there was a willful act of the repudiation of and rejection of the authority of Rome, and thereby, in order to curry the favor of the local monarchs, there was an overt and excessive emphasis of locality of power. Right now, I say that to the effect of, this language of imputation isn't devoid in Lutheran soteriology. It's just that for Luther, when it comes to the sacramental life and the participation of the volition of man, there's a complete rejection.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, historians who are much more conversant in the actual history of the time than I am have said and will say that, you know, there are ongoing reform movements in the church constantly. Before the 16th century, before the 5th century, going on now, there are constantly reform movements which are totally applicable and fruitful within the bounds of the Catholic Church as our Lord intended. Mm-hmm. And Luther happened, you know, he just reached a tipping point in his province, in his time, where there was the political and economic impetus and incentive from the local princes to push him forward. You know, he was really outspoken. He had tons of energy. He had tons of love, you know? I mean, I tend to read Luther pretty charitably. Mm. But in a lot of ways, his proposals, which had been proposed before in the life of the church, they just, for some reason, had that tipping point where they could move forward in a political way and really get traction.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working in a place in Europe in the north where indulgences were heavily promulgated. And, you know, I think the proposals that he put forward resonated enough to take on the life that they did. And that fissure in the church has persisted to this day, this fissure amongst Christians, this brokenness. And, you know, the impetus was, at its most basic form, to challenge the idea that the Pope had
So, Mary, we're going to have to take a break there, but we will continue this on the other side of this break. My guest, Dr. Mary C. Moorman, who is a lecturer in theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville and the author of Indulgences, Luther, Catholicism, and the Imputation of Merit. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
He was a doctor of the church, a Carmelite, and one of the most famous mystics of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of the Cross wanted to help all Christians to become saints. One of his most important teachings was to encourage us all to learn how to love. For there is no love, he said, put love, and you will find love. He died in 1591.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Suffering in the world, personal suffering. One of the biggest things that keeps people from really giving themselves over to the Lord or joining an organized religion. Suffering doesn't seem to make sense. Why do children suffer? Why are there wars? Why is there persecution? Why are some people poor, others rich? Why is there such an imbalance? And on and on and on. A loving God wouldn't do that. Well, God doesn't do that. First of all, we did it to ourselves because in the beginning, right, we chose incorrectly. And then sin came into the world. It was not supposed to be like this, but God gives us free will. He does not want to force himself on us because otherwise we would be puppets. But how many of us can look back and forget what came out of a particular hard time? You don't learn really good, strong lessons when everything is going great.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Most parents would like to raise generous kids, but where do you start? Well, authentic generosity doesn't start with serving strangers. It starts with looking for little ways families can make each other's lives easier at home. Start a new habit in your family. Make it a rule that everyone should look for one way to leave a room better than they found it. It doesn't matter who left the coat off the hook or who left the toy on the floor. If you see it, deal with it. The important point is, good teams don't bicker about whose job something is because everybody on the team is just committed to giving their all to get the job done. Practicing generous service at home is one of the most important things Catholic families can do. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. Mary C. Moorman, author of Indulgences, published by Emmaus Academic. So, Mary, we were talking before the break about how Luther and what he did. There was kind of prime opportunity historically here in that it hit a historical tipping point. And some of his ideas were novel to a degree, but a lot of what he intended to do was not, in fact, for the desire of complete rupture within the church. And it happened that way historically, and it's caused one of the greatest scandals in terms of the continued division of the church henceforth. But let's talk about Lutheran soteriology here. For our listeners who don't see the intricacies, Luther's theology of sola fide, by his own admission, does not stand for an admission of the doctrine of indulgences. In fact, it's one of those things that he was personally repulsed by. And so just kind of help us thread that needle here. Why is that the case? And what is the place of indulgences in Catholic doctrine?
Right. Okay, so that's such a good question. On the first prong, the part about indulgences that Luther did not like was the claim associated with it that the Pope and the Church and the bishops have authority and jurisdiction in some sense over our life beyond the grave in purgatory. I mean, that was a conversation, a set of questions that was going on in the academic circles of Europe in a really vivid way in Luther's time. And he, you know, he wanted to challenge that. He did not like the idea of the Pope wielding the keys of the kingdom that Christ had entrusted to Peter in such a way that could pertain to the treasury of merit that we understand as the merits of the saints, that could be applied to the soul in purgatory beyond our death. He wanted the Pope's jurisdiction to be purely temporal, and he wanted the Church's jurisdiction to be purely temporal. And we see that, interestingly, applying to Luther's theology of marriage. He wanted to say that marriage was not a sacramental union, purely a juridical, temporal kind of legal mechanism. He didn't even want marriages taking place within a church building, necessarily. So it's really interesting. And the popes who responded to Luther used imagery from the Song of Solomon in critiquing him. He says, mm-hmm. They said he's like one of the little foxes who spoils the vineyards that mm-hmm. are a symbol of the marriage union. He said he's compromising everything, like the idea of the church's intrinsic union with Christ.
Right, right.
Which goes down to our understanding of the ontological union, the sacramental union of man and wife in sacramental marriage. So it was really interesting how they saw Luther as attacking the nuptial intimate union mm-hmm. of God and his people in his critiques, whereas, you know, bless his heart, Luther probably would have said he was trying to affirm the exact opposite. But in truth, in the church's critique, Luther attenuates the church's understanding of how near she is to her Lord, that she can speak for him and act for him in this world mm-hmm. and kind of intercede for the souls in purgatory, even beyond physical death. And I think in the church, the second prong of your question, in the church's life today, an indulgence's place in her doctrine. First of all, indulgences do bear witness to this very vital aspect of covenant within our theology, and which has its consummation in our understanding of the covenant between Jesus and his church. And is the most stunning, vivid, intimate, life-giving image that I think our world needs so much. Like, God is so close to his people that he wills to elevate them to his very life. Mm-hmm. And all he asks for our consent. We're not God. We're never going to be. We're creatures. But we can have this union with him that is so close that it's described, you know, we describe our union of man and wife as something like the union that God has with his people, that he desires with his people, that he's created us for and called us to. So I think that is so helpful. At mm-hmm. the end of my book, another aspect, this is the last phrase in my book, and I'll just read it. I say maybe that the future of theological commentary on indulgences is not so much just the task of commenting on how we are saved but of recalling who we are. And I think that is maybe one of the most vital aspects in our age, as we talk about indulgences, when we remember the great dignity that God has invested in the human person. And the church sends her wounded penitents. We're the ones who go to make covenant with God with indulgences when we've sinned. But she sends her sinners. She sends her most broken people, you know, to him to enact these covenants, which instantiate her entire life. And she lets her sinners do that. And I think that bears so much witness to God's mercy and to the dignity that he calls us to. Like, even in our brokenness, he has provided these means by which we can not only restore ourselves and redeem the time, but by which we enact union with him on behalf of the whole church.
Right.
And then lastly, I mean, it says so much about indulgences refer us to our death. You know, it's something that we don't think about enough, probably, even though it's in every statement of our Hail Marys. You know, I just got back from a trip to Mexico, and you see all these images of death portrayed as our sister, as St. Francis described our death, or this compelling, like, almost lover in the popular culture, because each of us is given death. You know, and Joseph Pieper talks about how death is, sort of a natural evil. It's not what God intended for us, but yet it is given to each of us. And it's something that in that way can be dignified and embraced as part of our redemption, whether we will have, an active control in the circumstances of our dying or not, you know, whether we are conscious or prepared or whether, you know, God forbid, we are all going to be given death at some point. And indulgences are all about preparing us for that time and reminding us that our lives are oriented to that moment, that provision in our redemption that will lead us to God and into everlasting life with him.
Yeah.
And I think most of all, indulgences remind us always, most importantly, of who God is and how he is. He has promised to receive what we bring to him. And I think this is such an important thing to remember in our age, that he is not just the God who gives in his mercy. He is the God who is merciful enough to accept and claim and receive what we offer him, and he will transform and redeem even the broken, messy things that we are able to offer him, the incomplete things that signify our whole selves. And in his hands, in his mercy, in receiving what we give him, he transforms our gifts into offerings that are acceptable to him, and he transforms us. And I think of this beautiful passage in Ezekiel where the Lord says, on my holy mountain, I will accept you and I will claim your tribute and the first fruits of your offerings and all that you dedicate. And I think in our age, it's kind of amazing to go beyond not just the God who gives everything so we have nothing left to offer, or the God who will restore and return that which we've given up. But it's the God who promises that he will receive us, that he will receive what we try to give to him.
Right.
And I think indulgences provide a really beautiful opportunity for that.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And that was a truly beautiful answer. And as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing that, I mean, even in reading your book, it becomes very clear. At play here is a kind of mystical ecclesiology that the Catholic Church has, you know, that the Church truly has this corporate body and yet unicity or oneness that Lutheran soteriology won't allow for, because with sola fide, with sola scriptura, you effectively elevate the individual over the notion of the corporate. And in that framework, I think you can begin to see why the notion of the imputation of the merits of another person towards my own salvation doesn't make sense. Touch on that if you would.
Sure. Well, I mean, what fundamental for indulgences is the idea that the merits of one can apply to another because we are truly one within the mystical body of Jesus, one with him and one with another in a mystical sense. You know, one of my colleagues and my dean, Dr. William Newton, has this beautiful point and a reminder about the early church's history where, you know, it was the people who had been excluded for denying the faith in times of severe persecution who would ask for letters from those who had persevered in their faith and who were in prison, maybe awaiting execution because they were confessing Christ.
Mm-hmm.
They would ask for them to write letters on behalf of the penitents who had failed. And the triumphant Christians would say, for my sake, echoing the language of St. Paul and like the letter to Philemon in the scriptures, for my sake, receive this guy. Him back for my sake. Like, I'm giving so much. He wasn't strong enough to give the same, but count what I have given to him.
That's right.
And let him back in. It's the exact same logic with indulgences. And so the idea that God will cover us with the merits of another, and that is possible within the mystical exchange of holiness within his body, because we are all one with him as our head, is very, I think, easier to understand and reference within the Catholic tradition. I mean, obviously, it's what Lutherans and Protestant Christians, all of our Christian brothers and sisters are called to. But they're all trying to kind of, I find, recover that vocabulary, like recover that concept. And in the Catholic Church, I feel like, you know, it's alive and well. We've never missed it. And I actually converted as an adult because I was looking for the place where that vision of Jesus meeting his people in nuptial union was alive and well. Not as something that we were looking forward to in the future in heaven,
but something
that was happening like daily. And then I was like, oh, this is happening in the Mass. The Catholic Church is the one who understands herself as the bride of Christ every moment of every day. You know, it's not something awaited for in the future, you know, after the resurrection. The resurrection, you know, when we are joined to Jesus again. It's happening now. So that's a great gift to be Catholic.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for making the time, Mary. My guest, Dr. Mary C. Moorman, who is a lecturer in theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. We've been talking about the place of indulgences in the life of the faithful. Her book, Indulgences, Luther, Catholicism, and the Imputation of Merit, published by Emmaus Academic. Thank you for joining us for today. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter.